Welcome to ACLU Studio, a podcast series for those who can't get enough of the ACLU. In our first episode, ACLU National Security Project Litigation Director Ben Wisner talks with award-winning journalist Michelle Shepard about her new book, Decade of Fear, Reporting from Terrorism's Gray Zone.
Hi, Michelle. Welcome to ACLU Studio.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
So, Michelle, this book is called A Decade of Fear. It's a very personal account of your reporting over the last 10 years in a variety of countries. In a way, it's kind of like a reporter's notebook of the post-9/11 decade. Now, tell us how this book came into being.
Well, in the media, we jump so quickly from story to story, and in the case of my beat, I was literally jumping from country to country. So I wanted to take time to reflect on all I had reported over the years, and because it had been all themed towards national security, I thought it would be a good opportunity to try and put the pieces together. And it really actually was quite cathartic to write through it and see how much everything had changed and hopefully what we'd learned in this decade.
Well, you say everything had changed, and the mantra that we hear so much here in the United States is that 9/11 changed everything. And there's been no bigger change than the articulation of what's been called the war on terror. What do you think about that as terminology, and what do you think about that as a national security strategy?
You know, I think that was the first mistake. I think we've now learned that that was a ridiculous name for what was going to follow. And as you said, the language itself changed, and that started really from day one with the Bush pronouncement that either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. And it really divided the world in a way now that we didn't see on September 10th. And, you know, I think it's kind of significant that I started this beat at ground zero. I got there the night of September 11th. I was a 29-year-old crime reporter. I didn't know much about national security issues or terrorism. So at that time, I really felt the anger and the fear and the sadness that everyone else did. And it was hard to fathom then where we would be now.
Well, you talk about the fear that was really palpable at ground zero and right around the attacks. And you've titled the book Decade of Fear. And I wonder, from my point of view, whether that is the most accurate title. I think maybe I would call it Decade of Fear Mongering. You spent a lot of time in the United States in the last 10 years. I mean, is it your impression that, you know, years after 9/11, it's genuine fear of terrorism that's motivating this? Or is this something that is really being more manipulated by political leaders?
Manipulated. And I think probably that is what I was getting at in the title, was that it was fear-mongering, that what happened after 9/11 was obviously very traumatic and people were scared. However, over the years, people simplified the issue of national security and terrorism into these very black and white terms. And that's why in the title I'm having a play as well on reporting from terrorism's gray zone. Really, the issue is very gray. And because we oversimplified the issue for so many years, and we had this rhetoric of fear that politicians capitalized on, we had many damaging foreign policies that, in effect, made us more at risk than we were before. So it was really, I think, this fear that governed so much, and that's when so many mistakes were made.
Right. I think there's probably no more potent symbol of a response to 9/11 that has compromised our security than Guantanamo, where you've traveled many, many times, about which you've already written one book about the Omar Khadr case, and where listeners should know you and I met and have spent a fair amount of time together covering military commission trials. Let's talk a little bit about Omar Khadr's case. Omar Khadr, our listeners probably will remember, is a Canadian citizen who was 15 years old when he was picked up by U.S. forces in Afghanistan, gravely wounded from a firefight in which a U.S. service member was killed, and has in fact spent a third of his life in Guantanamo. Your book is called Guantanamo's Child. Give us a bit of an update on what's going on with Omar Khadr now.
Well, he actually had his military commission hearing last fall, in which he pleaded guilty in return for a deal that would mean he would have one more year in Guantanamo, where, as you said, he's essentially spent more than a third of his life. growing up there, that means he will return to Canada to spend the remainder of his sentence in the next couple months. He has to return by October 31st. So that actually does bring to some end a case that's been going on for years. But his case was a really good example of how the issue of Guantanamo, and his case in particular, was completely oversimplified. I've never had a story over the years that people were so far on one side or the other. And, you know, unfortunately, that didn't change over the years, despite all the reporting we did and a book trying to explain the complexities of that case and the real issues that case represented. People still have a very visceral reaction to that case.
I'll never forget on my first trip to Guantanamo seeing Omar Khadr come into the courtroom wearing a rugby shirt as if to emphasize his youth and to sort of put that fact out there. It was a fascinating case, and I wonder if you could tell, you know, our American listeners, what do the Canadians think of all of this? What has been their response to Guantanamo in general and to the Khadr case in particular?
Well, I remember that day you're talking about very well as well. His lawyers, I think, later admitted that was their intention to have him come out in the rugby shirt. And it was not only a rugby shirt, but it was a Roots rugby shirt, which is a very well-known Canadian clothing company. So I think they wanted to emphasize the point that here he was, this Canadian youth. The Khadr case has divided Canadians, and that's largely because of his family. His father, Ahmed Syed Khadr, has since been killed. At one point, he was an associate of Osama bin Laden, and the Canadian government at one point had advocated for his release in Pakistan because he was being held without trial. I think once 9/11 happened and then the Khadr case emerged, Canadians felt very angry. They felt that this family was what had been dubbed Canadians by convenience, and they'd also been called Canada's first family of Al-Qaeda. And I think, unfortunately, in Canada, the hatred towards his family really overshadowed the larger issues of the Omar Khadr case, which was the fact that he was, one of the main facts was that he was 15 when he was captured and under international law would be considered a child soldier. The other main factor was that he is the only captive to be charged with a war crime of murder. And we've had over 5,000 U.S. forces killed in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And to date, Omar Khadr is the only one charged with murder.
You've made 23 trips to Guantanamo, probably second most among the journalist corps, but at least in the top five. And for our listeners, on those 23 trips, how many times were you permitted to sit down and interview a Guantanamo detainee?
Never once. I mean, that's one of the frustrating things about covering Guantanamo is that before we go, we have to sign ground rules set out by the Pentagon. And one of the rules is that we cannot communicate with the detainees. And this goes so far as if we're given a tour through the facilities, through the prison facilities, which we have been before, if a detainee is to shout out to us and try and communicate, if we are even to say hi back or something innocuous such as that, we can be kicked off the base. It's been one of the most frustrating reporting experiences because of the restrictions we face in Guantanamo. And essentially, we have to comply with them or we can't get on the plane to go.
One of our real frustrations with Guantanamo, of course, is that it's still open, long after President Obama mandated that it be closed. And one of the reasons, of course, that it's still open is because the Obama administration has adopted the position that it will not send any more detainees, even detainees cleared for release, back to Yemen. Now, Yemen is another country that you visited, that you reported on, and that you write about in this book. What brought you to Yemen?
It was actually that very issue. I went first to Yemen in 2009 to write about the issue of the Guantanamo detainees, because I realized this was going to be the problem. These were the problem detainees. They made up the majority of the remaining detainees, and Yemen was a country that the U.S. felt was not stable enough to return these men to. But what I found when I was there was that for every one detainee that was held in Guantanamo, there were dozens, if not hundreds, of relatives, either blood relatives or relatives of their tribe, that were so angry about the indefinite detention of these detainees that really it was that perception of the U.S. and that symbol of Guantanamo that at the time was damaging national security more than perhaps some of the detainees themselves.
Well, you might say the same thing about the U.S. policy of drone strikes and targeted killings. Of course, there are famous incidents, at least famous in Yemen, where the U.S. has killed women and children and civilians in attempting to go after al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And of course, the most famous alleged member of that group is Anwar al-Awlaki, whom the Obama administration has essentially publicly said that it is trying to kill. You found out something very unusual about al-Awlaki. When you mentioned his name in Yemen, what was the response?
No one knew who he was. And this was before he was dubbed terrorist number one in the U.S. and before the Fort Hood shooting and the underwear bomber and these cases that were allegedly linked back to him that put him on the radar. But at the time, speaking with people who really knew the ins and outs of al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, the al-Qaeda proxy in the area, they had never heard of al-Awlaki. They did not believe he was part of that group. I think part of the problem with the al-Awlaki case is that he was made larger, and he today is probably more of a threat than he was before, in part because of the U.S. reaction to him.
Yemen, of course, is one of the countries that has been roiled by democratic and protest movements in the last several months, and you actually end your book with a chapter on the Arab Awakening. Tell us a little bit about that and whether maybe you see glimmers of hope or optimism after such an awful decade.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I end the book with that my poor publisher, I had to rewrite the ending to this book three times, which is one of the difficulties with the current affairs book. I ended first with this very personal story about a double amputee in Mogadishu I'd met, and then handed that in just as the events in Tunisia and Egypt began, and I went to Yemen for a month to cover the uprising there. And then just as an aside, I actually handed that book in on May 1st, and later that evening, Obama announced that Osama bin Laden had been killed. So my very patient publisher gave me a few more weeks to wrap that up. But in Yemen, I think I learned a lot at the time that I was there during the revolutions, and it was similar to revolutions and street movements elsewhere. It was really quite inspiring because this is a country that did not speak out against the regime. It was very rare to have these types of public protests. So to watch these mainly youths, educated youth, many women, protest against the regime was really quite incredible. What I did learn, though, is that Yemen is an incredibly complex country. And unfortunately, over the years, we had been looking at it solely through this prism of terrorism. And when I was there, terrorism had nothing to do with it. AQAP, al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, was struggling to insert themselves into this, but they were not behind it. I do have a glimmer of optimism for Yemen. Unfortunately, it is a very poor country whose resources are running out, and I worry that we're on the cusp of a humanitarian crisis there the longer that this sort of stalemate plays out.
Michelle, I just can't resist asking you one more question. You found yourself on, I guess it's called a spy cruise. You were on a cruise ship with people who I might call the defenders and enablers of war crimes, the current and former heads of the CIA, Porter Goss, Michael Hayden, and others. And you had a chance to ask them about the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the answer somehow involved a packet of peanuts. Can you describe that odd encounter?
We found ourselves on this, as you mentioned, the spy cruise, which is a themed cruise where participants are able to listen to officials in the intelligence world speak about issues of national security. And on this cruise, they had two former CIA heads, General Michael Hayden and Porter Goss. And one evening, they had consented to do this interview. So we found ourselves in the Silk Den, which was one of the lounges on this cruise. And I brought up the issue of waterboarding, KSM, to which Porter Goss used bar nuts to demonstrate what waterboarding 183 times meant. So he was trying to show that it wasn't as outrageous as the claim had been, that he didn't believe it was torture, and by demonstrating, he was saying that they were simply drops of water, and it shouldn't be considered as horrendous as people had thought. Both men defended the practice, said it was effective. At that time, that was last fall. I thought that issue was largely dead. Once Obama had come in, it obviously had long been outlawed, and Obama denounced it as torture. What I didn't know was a few months later the issue would arise again with the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Right, and really the perverse argument that somehow waterboarding in 2003 resulted in bin Laden's killing in 2011. Sometimes the arguments that are made on the other side are so brazen it's hard to know how to respond. I'm speaking to Michelle Shepherd, award-winning reporter for the Toronto Star and author of Decade of Fear, Reporting from Terrorism's Gray Zone. Michelle, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben, for having me.